Welcome back to What Do You Do? My name is Orna Lyons, and in this podcast series, I speak to people who work in the music business all about their professional lives and the ins and the outs of what they do. This week, I'll be chatting with Jake Layton Pope. Jake is currently a manager. He manages Will Young and Anna Straker, amongst many other projects that he's involved in, and he also grew up in the music business. His dad was a very successful agent, and many of his family members work in the business today. Last but not least, he spent 10 years as a live agent at CAA. I've known Jake for many years now. We actually work quite closely together on a couple of projects. So I knew he'd have a lot of experiences and insights to share. In our chat, we talk about his path to becoming both an agent and a manager. And what I found interesting is that even though Jake had family connections to begin with, you'll hear that his journey was far from linear, not without challenges and also with some health struggles, which he touches upon in this episode. If you've never really understood the difference between an artist's agent and their manager, I think that's one that people sometimes get mixed up, then this week's episode will be a perfect breakdown of what each of these roles entail. So I really hope you enjoy. If you do, please subscribe or leave a rating on the podcast app, as it helps people to discover the series. Thank you so much for listening, and let's get straight to it with Jake Layton Pope. Welcome, Jake Layton Pope.
Hey, Orna.
So, what do you do?
Well, I now am a manager. I started a company called 10,000 Steps. I started it about a year ago, but I named it about 3 months ago or 2 months ago when I left CAA, where I'd been for 10 years as an agent, and I started a management company, and I didn't know what to call it, and I didn't know what to do with myself, and I'd not done any exercise for a long time, and a friend of mine said, you need to walk 10,000 steps a day. So I did, and now it's become a bit of a mission statement, you know, step by step, you know. So I am a manager now, I suppose, to begin with.
Going back, you were an agent for 10 years, as you mentioned. How did you get into the industry, and what was it like being an agent?
I've got a very well-known name, so nepotism is obviously going to come into play somehow, somewhere down the line. My father's an agent, my older brother's an agent, my younger brother's a promoter. But I started working for the family business in the summer, booking Chippendale shows, actually. Not even booking at that point, just getting routing. Before there were email, you know, you could email and get lists of available dates. You literally had to phone every theatre and find out who was when the dates were available and then put a tour together. So I used to phone up and say, hi, my name's Jake, in a kind of squeakier 16-year-old voice. Hi, my name's Jake, I'm from the Chippendales. Do you have any availability? You know, and actually, you know, it stands you in good stead, because when you eventually become an agent, you just spend a lot of time cold calling or calling and calling to sell your artists. My road to actually becoming an agent was a sort of patchy one. I started in earnest as a manager, mm-hmm. which is kind of what I've gone back to, with a very fantastic mentor called Mark Moreau, who had run Island Records and eventually had run Universal, and had signed an incredible amount of... I think he'd won three of the first five Mercury Music Prizes, from Pulp to the Cranberries to A&R U2 for 10 years. I mean, he was
incredible.
An incredible mentor.
Yeah.
And he'd left the record business and signed two artists. And I went and worked for free for him for about 3 months. And he had signed Richard Ashcroft on his second solo album and Paul Oakenfold as he was making his first solo album, Bunker. And he turned around to me and he said, look, I need somebody to go and work with Paul in America. Would you mind living in America for a couple of months? Which I had to think about for about 3 seconds.
What age were you at this time?
24, 25. I'd been to university in America, so I was kind of very, and my family had a house in LA, so I was very comfortable about being in America.
You're kind of perfectly set up for that job then.
Yeah. I was very confident to go and do it. But I really didn't know very much about dance music and wasn't really a fan. I was always in the rock space. And I thought I'd probably end up working more with Ashcroft. I didn't, which I was kind of thankful for in the end. Mainly because Oakenfold became a mentor to me, which, you know, a lot of people don't realise about Paul, but he was really the first superstar DJ.
Oh, yeah. He was huge back then.
Yeah, he was number one DJ in the world at that time. But he was just a grafter. You know, and he really worked hard and he pushed me to work harder. But what his real skill was, and I think the skill that you need to have as a manager particularly, is an inner A&R skill, you know, an ability to listen to records, think about how records can be better, and then help artists work out how they can make them better. Because the hardest thing in the music business is to finish a song. You know, I know a lot of the sort of common way of making records now is to do lots of speed dating, lots of sessions. And you end up having a sort of 50 to 5, 60% song on one day. The next 50 days to get to 100% are really, really hard. And Paul was brilliant at it because he understood what worked in clubs. So he understood how records needed to build and how they needed to be layered. And he knew it, and he was very decisive, and he knew it when he heard it. And I remember we were making Bunker in one studio, and we were making the soundtrack to a film called Swordfish that starred Hugh Jackman and Halle Berry and John Travolta. And it was the first film that studio had made after The Matrix. So there was a huge budget for it. So we were making that soundtrack in one studio, and we were making Bunker in another studio at the same time. And I learned loads. I was a T-boy. I mean, I was running around, you know, from getting, you know, doing business stuff to, you know, collecting laundry. So, you know, I was 25 and, you know, was driving Paul around and having a really good time. Anyway, long story short, we then signed another act called Lemon Jelly, who I had been involved in bringing in. And then I started managing a fantastic female singer called Willis, which is sort of a forgotten record, but a beautiful record if you go and check it out. It's called Come Get Some.
So,
and
then, that was the beginning stages.
That was the beginning. And at that point, I thought I was going to start, I was going to kind of branch away from Mark and start my own thing with Willis. And actually, for about 10 minutes, I did. However, I got sick. And at that point, I found out I had a kidney disease and an inherent, you know, disease that came from genetics rather than anything else. There was no bad behaviour. Although I grew up in the music business, I'm not a drug guy and fairly healthy living. And so I got a disease and my kidneys failed. And within a 12-month period, I was on dialysis. And within a further 12-month period, I had a transplant. I was 29 years old. And it was terrible, you know. And I think most people trying to break into the music business will know that at that 27, 28, 29 age, you start to feel like you've paid your dues. You've collected enough laundry and made enough tea. You're starting to get responsible work. I was actually managing people.
And you kind of had to stop.
And I kind of had to stop, yeah. And I really kind of had to pause my career. Mentally, I think I had to do it more than physically. Live Nation were great. My brother was working at Live Nation at the time. Stuart Galbraith was running it. And they gave me some sort of pickup work to be a rep, a promoter's rep, which basically means running shows every night in and around London. You know, and I remember doing a Mastodon show at the Garage when they were a tiny band, 600 capacity, and having to do, I had a little smart car at the time, and I was doing dialysis in my smart car, but behind the Garage while repping Mastodon. But you know, it was a really great experience. I repped the first four James Blunt shows, and I remember him standing on stage sound checking and me going, wow, this guy's going to be huge, this record's going to be huge. Just four songs that he was playing in sound check were just amazing.
So, and you began in management, you got ill, it forced you to stop, and then because of that you kind of fell into the agent side of things via being a rep, is that correct?
There's a bit more to it. I went and had a transplant from my mum, thank you very much. She's the real star of the family. I came back and I started repping for Live Nation because I'd been working for them. Then I started repping again. I actually went out on the first James Blunt tour. And then I did a bunch of festivals and I did Download and Eagles in Hyde Park and Eagles in Cardiff Stadium and all these kinds of things. And I looked around and went, I can't have a kidney transplant and then eat McDonald's at 2 a.m. It's just not going to work. But they kept offering me work and I kept taking it. And so I just one day just said, that's enough, and I'm just going to quit. So I quit the music business completely, and I stopped working in music absolutely completely. A friend of mine, Rich Perry, who you know, was living next to a guy who was an old guy and sadly died, and I bought the guy's flat off his kids who he'd left it to.
So you were out. You were
done. I was out.
Yeah.
And I became a property developer for a year, and I built this flat, we renovated it, a university friend of mine and I did it. I didn't touch music for a year. It was really funny because he's a builder and I know nothing, I'm terrible. And we're sort of thing and he's trying to teach me how to do this stuff. And I'm listening to the radio and I can remember Lily Allen's Smile was a hit. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I know who manages her and I know the record company. And then another record come on and I'd be like, oh, that's a great record. And, you know, and my university friend just turned around to me and said, listen, you are absolutely terrible at building. Like, you're awful and you're never going to get any better. But you know every record on the radio and...
That's what you should be doing.
You should go back and do that. And so
talk to me about when you weren't doing it. Did you miss it? Because you'd grown up in the music industry. That's what you'd always done. Or do you think you needed that break?
I needed to reset, but I always miss it because it's what I know. Mm-hmm. I think that you have to find a healthy relationship with it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a lifestyle business. I think for the majority of people that get into the music business, they live the life. And I think you have to come to some conclusion that that's okay. That's what you want to do. You know, and whether that's dealing with the nonsense that comes with it or riding the highs and lows or living out in the evenings or, you know, kind of rolling with the changes of the business.
It's not a 9-to-5 job.
No. Yeah. And I think you have to live with it. You have to understand that that's what you want to do. And I just had unfinished business with it, really. So, and this is another good sort of thing, really. When you know lots of people... And the only way to know lots of people is to start working in the music business. This is my way you start.
How do you start? Let's say if you don't know anybody, how do you start? How do you get in?
You start by going to where it is, where the music is. Don't be asked to be in the music business. Just, I'm in the music business. I'm going to go to that club and I'm going to meet the DJs and I'm going to meet the bands and I'm going to manage someone or I'm going to run a club night or I'm going to put a party on or I'm going to volunteer or I'm going to... literally apply for every internship. I'm going to be in the music business. The music business is not going to give me permission to be in it. I'm just going to be in it, you know. And it seems very simple, but actually, if you ever meet anybody in the music business, they've all got similar stories. They decided they wanted to be in the music business, and they just went after it.
Yeah.
They didn't say.
And you don't have to. You know, you can't, and you don't have to start at the top. You can start off managing a mate or managing someone who's just trying to crack in themselves, and that way you'll make contacts and you'll kind of learn on the job.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the contacts grow from, because obviously everybody starts there. So, you know, I remember when I was with Paul, we had a very small office. We had our own management office, but Paul had an office for his label, Perfecto, in the Mushroom office. And Mushroom at the time were having huge hits with Garbage and who else did they represent at the time? Corder Marshall was killing it. Mm-hmm. So I was in that office quite a lot. You know, there was Corder and I became friends because I was in the office a lot. Paul was there. And then in the basement, there was a guy who just released this record by 07 who no one sort of knew. And suddenly he's the hottest guy out there because he's got this great record and he's a great guy and he's got great ears and he's a great A&R man. You know, fast forward 25 years, he's running Universal's Max Lusada.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I didn't know he was going to run Universal when I met him. Or, sorry, when Warner Brothers, pardon me, Max. But, you know, I didn't know he was going to do that. You know, I didn't know that Corder would go on to do what he did. And I didn't know that, you know, we didn't know anything because we were just all in it at the same time. You know, and they were way higher than me at that time anyway. But they were good to me.
It's a good point, and I think it's an interesting one of when you start in the music industry to... get to know everybody, because you never know who's going to end up running the show in 10 years, in 5 years, and even in a short space of time, people can go from having an unsigned act or working at a small label to jumping up massively. So it's a good point.
It's everything, because although we are now much more corporate business on every level, whether it's the Spotify's in the digital world or the AEG and Live Nations in the live world, there's only a couple of thousand people in the world that are in the music business proper, you know, and it's those people that make decisions. So, and I find the best people, even the people at the very top, are the people who care about the people at the bottom, you know, mm-hmm. or when you say the bottom, they're just starting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad and I spent, a friend of the old man's today asked if he would have an hour for his son who's trying to break into music business. My dad and I spent 2 hours with this young guy. He's at Edinburgh. He's studying the music business. He doesn't know how to get in. And we just sat and chatted with him for 2 hours because we were all there.
Okay, so you had taken some time out of the business. How and why did you get back in?
So I finish this building job, I make some money, and my mate tells me to go back in the music business. Back to this networking thing. I tag along with my brother, who's a promoter at Live Nation at the time, and we go to a few Christmas parties, music business Christmas parties, and we bump into a couple of guys that we know who are a bit crazy, who run a massive merchandise company at the time called Bravado. And they go, what are you doing at the moment? And I say, I'm looking for a job. And they go, great, start on Monday, do some A&R. And that was a conversation.
You're in.
So I go and see them, and they're in this warehouse. I mean, way past the laws changing, they're still smoking at their desks. I mean, it was crazy. And I love these guys.
They're absolutely brilliant.
They said, look, just come and sign some bands and we'll have some fun. And I'm like, I don't want to be in the merch business. I want to be in the music business. But one of the most important things about trying to get a job in the music business, if you're not on the pitch, you will never get the ball. If you're not on the pitch, you'll never get the ball. If you never get the ball, you'll never score a goal. You know?
I love that.
And the reality is that whoever offers you your moment to do whatever it is, come and work at a festival stage, come and do security at this, come and stand in a studio all day and make tea, whatever your moment is to get on the pitch, get on the pitch.
I love that.
I just think the opportunity on the pitch is really important. So I took this opportunity and I just got the phone book out and I went to see people I knew. And I signed Scan for Girls, who had literally just signed their record deal.
Great band.
And they were great and they're still great friends of mine now. I ended up becoming their agent for 10 years and they're wonderful people. And then the big ticket was the Spice Girls reunion.
The first one, which was 11 years ago.
And Bravado had done all the Spice Girls stuff before, and we had all the art and we had all the history. But 19 had really wanted to put it out as tender, and everybody was trying to get it. And I knew one person on the 19 staff, and for 8 months I chased that deal and eventually signed Spice Girls, which was huge. You know, as merch deals go, it was huge. And it was a real great feeling. I mean, I still wanted to be more in the music business and less in the merch business, but it was a big feeling to have been successful.
Even just to be a part of that tour and be part of that team of making, and merch is like that's the visuals that people see and that they almost associate with the tour.
Well, yeah, we built and I was involved in all of that, building a 42 item merch list, something like 17, 18 nights at the O2.
Amazing.
You know, and America and whatever. But then I was going around meeting everybody saying, you know, are you interested in merch deals? And at the very same time, William Morris and CAA, the big two American agencies, they didn't have presences in the UK. A lot of people sort of feel like they've been here forever, but they actually 11 years ago just started. William Morris came first and then CAA. I went to see my friend Sol Parker, he's an agent at Coda now, to see him to find out whether he's got any other acts going on. We were sitting in his office. William Morris is literally building itself at the time. There's like half the places didn't have computers and they were just building the office. And they'd asked an older guy who had started with my dad, called Ed Bicknell, to build William Morris. And Ed walks in and goes, oh, what are you doing here? And I go, oh, I'm looking for a job. And it was a joke, because obviously all the desks were empty and people were trying to fill. And he was like, well, good, there's a desk free over there, start on Tuesday. Which again, I thought was a bit of a joke. But I drove home and I thought, oh, that's a bit weird, isn't it? I mean, maybe I should go and be an agent. I didn't want to be an agent. And my dad was an agent. And I thought, I don't want
to be an agent. You obviously knew what the job was. You were familiar.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'd grown up. Families in the agency business. So I called Ed and I said, you know, what do you think? And he went, yeah, come in. So I went in and I had like this weird meeting with about four of massive agents. It was like intense, but I knew them all, so it was okay and it was great. And they wanted me to come and I wanted to go there. And then Emma Banks, the glorious Emma Banks, found out that I was talking to William Morris and kind of went, hey, I know you haven't been an agent. If you're going to be an agent, come and work for me at CAA. I made the decision to go to CAA mainly because of Emma, but really because Emma was going to just kill me for a couple of years and make me good. And even though I'd grown up in the business, you're not good until you've like done your 10,000 hours. You know, you're not good until you grind it out. And Emma killed me, just absolutely destroyed me for 2 years. And I, you know, hated her, loved her, and thank her now. I became a pretty successful agent at CAA for 10 years, you know, and was part of, you know, Black Keys success with Mike Greek, and did all the country stuff with Nigel Hasler, and you know, you and I did Gabrielle Aplin, which was fantastic to have an act that we did her first ever show all the way through to her sellout shows and her album successes. and everything in between. Scout for Girls, Texas, The Feeling, Seal. I mean, I did 50 acts, I think. And then about 8 years into it, 9 years into it, I kind of looked around and went, I'm kind of done. I'm 43, 42, whatever the time is. I've done everything I want to do in agency.
You've been to every venue.
I've been to every venue.
You've done
every
tour.
Enough festivals.
Yeah.
I've booked enough shows. I don't get a buzz from it. And I kept going to these planning meetings with managers and labels and publishers. And I'd kind of have loads of ideas of what I wanted to do with the artist. And then everyone would be like, yeah, that's a great idea, great idea. And I'd be like, okay, great. And then I'd get back to my desk and I go, oh, I've got to book shows. That's my function.
Yeah.
And I just kind of went, that's not for me. Now, a lot of people, you know, the great agents out there, they love the hunt. You know, they love the hunt for shows. Booking tours, getting tours great, booking, making deals, making money. The thrill of that sort of action.
Putting a tour together.
Yeah. And you know, as an agent, a really good agent is an agent who understands the band, understands the plan, and has an art to take an artist from a certain position to another position. You know, whether it's taking them from the bottom to the top, or whether it's maintaining where they are, or whether it's, you know, I remember Emma having a phone call from the System of Down guys going, we want to do a tour of Armenia with an orchestra.
And, you know, that Emma, doesn't sound straightforward.
You know, Emma, because she's the best agent in the world, went, sure. She had no idea how to do it.
But she just said, we'll make it happen.
3 days, she learned and she did it. But she is somebody, and Mike Greek and Nigel and Paul Wilson, and all those guys there, they love doing it. They love the challenge of making the best tour possible and making the most amount of money for their artist.
So you've touched on briefly what it is that an agent actually does, but just for anyone who has never heard of what an agent is or doesn't really understand what they do, what do they do on a day-to-day basis, or what are they responsible for?
The word agent gets confusing because you hear of agents in a film sense.
And they're more like managers.
And they're more like managers. So if you're a film or TV agent, you kind of do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Your main role is to get your artist's work, but you'll be more involved. Music agents are singly representative of live work. So every time an artist does a show, the agent would have booked that show. Now, when you say book that show, who does he book it with? Well, typically it's with promoters or venues or festival owners. But the main relationship is the artist represented by the manager. So the manager will instruct the agent. The agent will then call a promoter and debate what should you do in that town. So I think the artist is worth 1,000 tickets. Okay, so what venue can we play in your town for 1,000 tickets? Okay, there's these three venues. Okay, what availability have they got in the touring period that we want? Okay, well, we've got the 3rd of June. Okay, it's the 3rd of June. It's 1,000 capacity. Now, in the marketplace, what kind of band are we ticket-wise, or artist?
And how do you know that? How do you know how many tickets a band can sell? Is it?
In a lot of ways, it's a hunch.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest tickets to sell are the first ones, right? So you get 100 tickets sold out. Okay, we sold out 100 tickets on the first day. Okay, well, we must be worth 300 then. You know, if we got 100 tickets, we sold them out in a day, I'm pretty confident we can sell 300.
Mm-hmm.
And we just sold 300 out in a day. Oh, okay.
Then you
so the next venue, we sold 300 tickets in a day. Maybe it's 800 now. You know, 800, we've got 3 months to sell it, or 6 months to sell it, you know, whatever it is, let's go, you know. Might move quicker than that. There's a, you know, especially in London, there's a natural progression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can start at 100 capacity, you know, small club, you move to something like the Hoxton Bar and Kitchen, you move to Amira, you move to...
There's almost a clear path.
You move to the Scala, you go from the Scala to, you know, maybe you go to Heaven, or you think you're happening enough to go to Shepherd's Bush, you go to Shepherd's Bush, you do a couple of Shepherd's Bushes, Brixton, a couple of Brixtons, Wembley, O2. There's a pattern to it. And that, you know, you can see a lot of indicators. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, those numbers are relevant. Spotify.
Record sales.
Record sales are more important in a lot of ways than for, depends on the act. You know, if you're looking at an artist who's traditionally sold records,
mm-hmm.
you want to look at their record sales.
Yeah.
And of course, they're going to be lower than they were in the past, but it's still week one, did you sell, you sold 25,000 records? Okay, in the country, we have 25,000 hardcore fans that want to buy a ticket.
Yeah.
That's probably 50,000 tickets. You don't go on your own, right? You buy two tickets. So, but you don't want to look at record sales for a pop act, because if you're a One Direction or a Little Mix or a that type of pop act, you're probably buying four tickets for every one album because you're taking your family. It's a family of four.
Interesting.
Right. So, but you build up these things over time and there's a lot of expertise in it, which comes from a hunch. Ticket price is harder. Ticket price is harder to gauge because...
So who decides the ticket price?
There's a debate between you as an agent mm-hmm. and the promoter, and you'll come to some kind of conclusion, and then you'll take it back to the artist and you'll go, this is what it is. The maths of it is quite important because the ticket price is set by the market value. So, you know, let's take an artist who is doing theatres. The average ticket price of a theatre sits somewhere between £29.50 and £65. So somewhere in between that, there is a ticket price that you feel comfortable as an artist delivering. The average is out around £40.
Mm-hmm.
Seated theatre, right? Which is a grown-up act, older artist, older demographic. People want the seat. They want that nicer experience. It's more expensive. So you have to counterbalance that with the amount of tickets you're going to sell and the costs of the building and the cost of promoting the artist. So how much are the posters going to cost? How much the online stuff's going to cost? How much is the marketing budget? How much are the security and the venues to hire, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, there's so many things to consider.
Production, blah, 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 blah. So it's a real easy equation. And there's when you, as you're an agent, you deal in one particular form, if you like, or one particular Excel spreadsheet, and we call it an offer. And that offer will start at the top with the capacity of the venue, the average ticket price. It will take off VAT and it will take off PRS. And then it will net yourself down to, you'll take off all the costs, blah, 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 blah. Promotion, security, venue hire, sound and lights, catering, all of those things that are as a list.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that list grows the bigger the venue, you know, to when you're doing things like stadiums, you're like, how much do forklifts cost? How much do trackway cost? How much does, you know, the stage have to mm-hmm. be built, etc. But it's the same equation. You get to the bottom and you go, okay, well, there
taking all of this into account.
There's X left.
Yeah.
And the promoter will offer you based on what's left. Now, the standard deal is an 80-20 split to the artist. But it's guaranteed, which is the most important weapon that a manager and artist have, agent, manager, artist have, is that if you as a promoter want to promote my artist and you're in a town and you think that that artist can do 10,000 tickets, then I'm going to hold you to that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a guaranteed
fee. They take
fee.
A lot. They do take some risk.
The promoter takes all the risk. And for people to sort of think, well, you know, promoters don't take, they make loads of money, they don't take any risk. Promoters lose lots and lots of money.
Yeah, because they still have to pay even if you don't achieve the ticket sales that they'd hoped.
Absolutely. It's guaranteed. There's a guaranteed fee. Now, you all make, so we do these deals called... they're called versus deals, but a simpler word is or. So you have, let's say, £10,000 guaranteed or 80% of the net box office receipts after costs, whichever's greater. So there's a split at the bottom. And that bottom split, if we sell more tickets than we think we're going to sell, we'll all win. We'll all make more money.
Yeah.
You know, the artist will make 80% of every pound or dollar made. Now, when you're at the very, very top level, if you're promoting Bruce Springsteen or Muse or one of those bigger stadium U2 type acts, those deals get into the 95-5 deals because they're basically saying at that point, Bruce
knows how many
I've
tickets
never
he's
not
worth.
Sold out a show. Yeah. If you want to have the privilege of promoting me and working with me, you're just going to have to guarantee me the 90%.
Mm-hmm.
And promoters are happy with that because they are, that's the cream.
Yeah.
However, on the flip side, for lots of black magic, some shows just don't sell. They just don't sell. So when you go, next time you go to an arena and you see a section half full or empty, that is the promoter profit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of the bigger promoters are now multinationals, Live Nation, AEG, and Live Nation in particular, because they are Ticketmaster, earn a lot of money on the ticket, regardless of the show. So the ticket is obviously... every time you sell a ticket, it's £10, but there's a £2 booking fee. That £2 booking fee is an administration fee that goes into Ticketmaster's pot. Some of it goes to actually sending you the ticket. Some of it goes to the administration, but there is a turnover of money. So Live Nation's business plan is based on Ticketmaster, feeding Ticketmaster, tickets, 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 mm-hmm. tickets. But they lose. They lose money. They also win big. You know, when you see big tours selling out, there's a lot of money to be made. We're in the $100 million business now.
Yeah.
You know, especially for the bigger tours.
And I think contrary to belief, people still want to go see live music. You know, it's still one of the most popular things around. And I think it's people like to bandy around that no one goes to gigs anymore. But, well, that's not my experience. Do you think that?
Well, you live in London. London is the most successful concert-going market in the world. The O2 is the most successful music venue in the world.
Wow, I didn't know that.
It's a little skewed because all of the other arenas in America have sports in there,
yeah,
whereas we don't. But in recent times, you know, I think the multiple run of dates, 17 nights of the Spice Girls, and it was 20 odd nights with was it Bon Jovi did 20 nights or something, Michael Bublé did 10, Prince did 23 nights.
So people, you know, are still people
London
still
is insane,
see. Yeah,
you know, on a summer's day in London, you can have Adele selling out Wembley at 80,000. You can have Hyde Park going strong at 60,000 sold out, and the O2 sold out, and quite easily Twickenham at 80 as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the appetite for live music in London is huge. The appetite for live music in the world is growing. You know, the markets that are opening up now, which is where agents make, you know, real impact, I think, nowadays. I think the structure of the music business, certainly in Europe and America, is very... I suppose it, back in the day, 40 years ago, when the guys, you know, my dad, Barry Dickens, you know, these guys, they started, their business was building. There wasn't any venues. There wasn't any arenas. The arena business didn't really exist. The only people doing arenas were Led Zeppelin. They were doing sheds. Over the last 30, 40 years, we've built real facilities. We've got real safety.
Yeah.
We've got real promoters. We've got ticketing systems. We've got a lot of transparency. There's a lot. There's tons of money in it, and there's a lot of expertise. I don't know how you hang these things off the roof. You need somebody who knows what he's doing, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that the business now is very structured. However, in a lot of other territories, Africa, Eastern Europe, so much Eastern Europe, but Russia certainly, you know, we're only in two or three cities in Russia. We should be in the whole of Russia, for example. China is just coming online. Tons of arenas in China.
Yeah, so much potential.
Korea's obviously. India has just begun. That circuit's developing. So the live business and where agents go is growing and growing. South America is a massive business, but it's only massive at the top level. There's no club business there. So it's hard to build acts from the start. You really have to have a name. But, you know, Iron Maiden can turn to 100,000 people every night in Brazil. And that's the value of a good agent. You know, value of a good agent is to know everyone, have good contacts, and have a really good vision for what you want the artist to do. And I think knowing your artist is an agent is a really important skill. You know, it's like, you know, there's certain rooms that are not good for certain artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think when you build an artist that has a particular kind of aesthetic, if you stray away from the aesthetic, the relationship between the artist and fan is a tender one. And I think if you put the artist in a bad room or on a festival bill,
that
doesn't
work. Or a
room
that's too big too soon.
Too big too soon. You know, I think people love a sold out show. You know, that old club thing of leaving people on the door, not being able to get in is great.
It's a good look.
Yeah, and I think, you know, knowing when the momentum is with you. It's with Ed Sheeran right now. Right? He can't not sell out.
I know.
But there'll be a moment where that will turn. You know, he'll still sell out big, big shows everywhere, but it won't be as rabid as now. So when you see him do the Nebworths and the big, big things, you have to know your moment and you have to take it. And I think that's a very different scenario that we have right now. And I think the big challenge for the business as a whole at that level is to continue to create superstars.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things we are seeing right now is the superstars are old. You know, the Elton Johns, the Rolling Stones, the Paul McCartneys.
And there's less and less
and these guys are still doing 50, 60, 70,000 people a night.
Yeah, there's less and less artists actually getting to that stage, younger artists.
But then there's that argument that the room has to be opened.
True.
Like the roof at the moment is dominated by these artists that have been around since the 60s. And the reality is that those guys are in their mid, late 70s and they won't do it in 5 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
Muse will.
Yeah.
U2 will. You know, there are a bank of artists coming through. We just have to keep stoking it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much, much faster now. Even in the 10 years that I was an agent, it became much, much faster from zero to somewhere really quickly.
So going back to you as an agent, you mentioned that you had kind of lost the love of booking shows and it wasn't for you. Had you lost that love for live music or being at the actual gigs also? Or what was the moment where you decided, I'm done?
I'm lucky that I actually just like being around music and musicians. So I didn't really get tired of going to shows. I mean, you know, I'm 44-year-old grumpy man, so of course I'm going to have a moan. But I like being at shows. You
know? It's exciting.
I like being out. I like being at shows. I don't know an agent that can watch a whole show. You know, once you've done four shows a week for 10 years, it's hard to watch a whole show.
Mm-hmm.
You end up having to kind of watch three or four songs and have a little wander around and watch another couple of songs. I've taken a year off and actually I've quite enjoyed it. A year off from going to gigs a lot. I actually went to two shows this week. I went to see Bublé on Thursday and Hugh Jackman last night. And actually, I went to Will Young on Sunday as well, who I now manage. So I've done three shows in the last 4 days.
That sounds like an agent schedule.
But I didn't fall out of love with music or the music business. I think what people don't understand about agency is a function job. You open a spreadsheet up and you fill dates. That's your main function.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of kind of energy and effort into what an agent does and how an agent can sell you. And that's great. And I get it. And you need to have that personality and you need to have that vision. And that really makes a difference in an artist's career by kind of going, I think we can do this. And I mean, I remember Scam for Girls, for example. I sat in front of the management, sat in front of the band. I went, we can do a matinee at the Palladium. They'd never done a matinee. And everyone went, what are you talking about? I'm like, it's Christmas. We can do a matinee. We've got a Saturday night and a Saturday afternoon and we'll do business and it'll be great. And we did like a sold out Saturday evening and 75% on the Saturday afternoon. And it was great, you know. But you have to have that mojo and that vision to kind of go,
think of something.
This is it. And also you have to put your career on the line. You have to convince an artist. I don't have to stand on stage. None of us on this side of it have to stand on stage. They have to stand on stage and do what they do. So if you're putting them in a bad situation and you've sold them an idea that's a bad situation, if you haven't bothered to really think, hold on, is my artist going to enjoy this show? You are really doing a disservice. So I didn't have any problems with any of that side of it. My love came from the admin, you know, and the volume, you know, booking lots and lots. I probably book 500 shows a year, 400 to 500 shows a year. And I just lost the love of the chase.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, some agents absolutely love that. And if you're that kind of person who likes turnover and being busy and organized and hunting for things, and every time you get ruthlessly, agency business lives on commission. So every time your artist gets a show, you get paid.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're one of those guys that just lives on that commission and that drive of like, I'm going to really break this artist and I'm going to make money and I'm going to book shows.
Then being an agent is for you.
It's a brilliant job.
Yeah.
You know. There's great agencies now. They've all consolidated in the last 10 or 15 years, you know, where you can have real careers, 10, 15, 20-year careers. And they're going to be more consolidated and more kind of structured and more controlled, which is great, which it's exactly how the business should go.
But for you, you felt like that was the end of the road. You were ready for something new.
I just wanted to get back to making and being part of that process.
Back to the beginning.
Back to where I started, yeah. Really, I just wanted to get back to that, what Paul Oakenfold and I had been doing when I was 25, you know, and I spent all summer up until Christmas helping to make records, you know, and I'm not a musician, I'm just another set of ears. So we made the Will Young record, we made a load of records for a new artist that you and I evolved in together, Anna Straker. We made another record that will come out, which is a totally different project. And I've signed a couple of guys who are producer writers and I'm enjoying developing them. And now I'm spending the next half of this year putting these records out. You know, so there's a totally different flow to my life now. It's like put records out, make records, put records out, go on tour, make records. There's a sort of cyclical, I'm not doing the same thing every day.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're that kind of guy who just loves the chase and loves the hunt and likes that repetition and that comfort, agency's brilliant. But for me, I just had that feeling that I wanted to be more creative and I wanted to do more things and different things. And, you know, I'm working with some people on podcasts. I'm working with some people on a children's thing. You know, I'm working with an app. I'm doing lots of different things.
Did you find that you had to learn new skills when you moved over into management, or did you inherently know how to be a manager? And, you know, managing Will Young, that's a big job. He's a big artist. Did you have to learn any new skills, or was it something that you knew?
I think I'm fortunate from 2 decades of experience to be able to, if not answer questions, know the questions to ask.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that, you know, if we're this podcast being listened to people that are trying to break into music or at least trying to demystify it, I think one of the things you should really take hold is that there isn't stupid questions, that this business is not written down.
Yeah, it's ever changing.
It changes all the time. Some of these conversations are gut feelings. Some of these decisions are made, you know, in the best intention, but the wrong results. And if you are afraid of asking questions, and if you are somebody who kind of goes, I know it now, you will fail because it changes all the time. And the difference between managing one artist and managing a different artist, although the functions are the same, the aesthetic and the way you approach these things aren't very different. Because when you are managing an artist, and in some ways when you're an agent, although it's a much more functional trade, when you're managing an artist, you represent who they are. And that's a very close, very personal thing, you know. And if you decide that you are this kind of manager and this is the way you manage things, and you aren't, you know, you don't listen to your artist, you don't listen to the way they want to be represented, I just feel like you'll always come unstuck. Mm-hmm. Now, I think back in the day, there was that cricket bat, bash on the table, you know, screw you kind of attitude to everyone, and you'd always go and get the bully boy manager, and that's how. And there's still those guys out there. That's their style. And some artists like that. Some artists are very comfortable with the tough guy or tough girl because they're not tough and they want somebody who's going to do that bulldog thing. I think there's another generation of managers who are really smart, really thoughtful, really creative, understand the parameters of this business that we're in right now, which is a very different business than what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, financially and the way it works. And I think that there's a lot of mutual respect between artists and managers when you get that right combination. And if you are going to manage somebody and you want to be a manager, you know, I think just sort of understand that it's like getting married. You know, you have to kind of fall in love with each other. You have to court each other.
And you need to be their biggest fan.
You do need to be their biggest fan, but you also need to fall in love with each other. You know, the artist...
Not literally.
No, but kind of. You know, the artist and you need to come to a trust position.
Yeah.
It's business, but you need to have that. You're not dealing in microchips.
Yeah.
You're dealing in someone's soul in
certainly
a lot of ways. You
trust.
Know? Trust, right?
Trust is huge.
You know? And when you're... And that trust comes really vital when you have to say something negative.
Yeah.
And you have to say, we can't get that for you. Mm-hmm. Or... This we didn't isn't get working. That playlist, or we're not going to get that festival offer. I want to talk to you about your performance because I just didn't think it worked. Do it again. That does not happen in the first meeting. That happens over some time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to court each other. You have to fall in love. You have to get married. And then at some point you'll get divorced, you know, because that's just the way it is.
You know,
the artists change, you change. And, you know, how many managers stay with their artists for the full ride? Very few. But this is just a natural thing.
Yeah.
You know, you run out of ideas, they run out of ideas, you run out of patience, whatever. And my experience now, and I'm 1,000 times better manager than I would have been 10 years ago or 20 years ago, because I've just done time, you know. And honestly, I spend half the time asking the label and the live guys questions and reaffirming things and, you know, asking about how this works and how that works.
I love that, though, because it just goes to show that nobody has all the answers, but it doesn't matter that you don't have all the answers. It's just being aware of what you need to know, and also knowing your artist and knowing that you're the best person for the job, because they get you, you get them, and you have that trust. Don't think you need to know everything. And different managers have different skills. Some are better at this, some are better at that, and you don't necessarily need to know everything, as long as you've got that trusting relationship.
Yeah, I think the words "I don't know" are fine. You know, as long as you follow up with, I'll find out.
Yeah.
You know, your artist says to you, what do you think about Radio 2? I don't know. You know, let's ask someone.
Yeah.
And when you're working on a Will Young campaign by any other name, it's not you. There are lots of different people doing very good jobs. The radio guys are doing their job. The press guy's doing that. The TV person's doing this. You know, you have to respect their expertise. Mm-hmm. But what you have to also understand is that you're representing the aesthetic of it. So when you're asking a TV question, you're asking it on behalf of your artist.
Yeah.
And you want to understand, you know, how's your artist going to feel about that? Because, again, you, me, everyone else on this side of the fence do not have to go and do the promotion, do not have to stand up, did not write the song, don't have to play in front of an audience. So when you're putting your artist in an uncomfortable position, you have to have a reason for it. And sometimes it's worth doing. It's about looking at the picture that you've got available to you and making decisions with your artist on behalf of your artist what the artist is trying to get to. You know, and as long as you're trying to be honest with that, I think you've got a good shot. You know, and luck. You need it. You need the luck. You just do. None of us know. None of us know if it's a hit record or
not.
We
like to think we do, but we don't.
It's just impossible. You know, the records I've heard and gone, yeah, really? And then gone, what? That's number one. You know, the records I've heard and gone, that's the greatest record I've ever heard, and never got out of the starting box. You know, there was a band who I represented really early as an agent, and I could be hand on heart and say there's certain bands that certain music genres that I wasn't great at. I was never good at indie. It's not my scene. And I represented this indie band called Goldhawks, and they had one of the best singles that I'd heard that year. And we couldn't get it away. And we, big record company, great management company, great artist. And it was like, they're gone, done. And I was so heartbroken by it because I was like, I love this record. You don't make the decision. People make the decision. Just do a good job. People will buy it or they won't buy it, and you'll know. And then when you feel that you've got that momentum, that's where you have to really, on a business front, that's when you really have to capitalize.
Yeah. So you come from a musical family yourself. Knowing what you know about the music industry now, would you be happy for your kids to work in the music industry?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely, yeah.
You'd advise people to get into it?
I think if it's a passion, don't get into it because your dad's in it. I think I look back at it and I think I probably should have done something else. You know, I probably should have gone into film or TV or just done something else just to break the kind of Leighton Pope mantra. You know, I was standing...
It's in your blood, Jake.
Honestly, I was standing behind... you know, the gong at UFO rock and roll shows when I was 5 years old. And once you get that bug, that's it. You know, we were at a video shoot yesterday, you know, listening to a live performance, and Will sung his heart out. And I was like, wow, you know, this is what I do. This is what the buzz is. The buzz is being around really talented people.
I love those tiny moments that just remind you occasionally, whether it's a show or when you listen to a song for the first time from your artist or music video or TV, and you just think, this is why I do this.
100%, you know, and being allowed to be a part of it, being allowed to kind of throw your idea in the mix and then, yeah, that's great, and it's all everything's collaborative. But I've got a daughter and a son, and, you know, the business is getting better for women, but it's not there yet. And it's a tough business.
Amen.
But it is, you know, it is getting better. There are far more women doing great jobs, but it's not there yet. We need to work harder. We need to be better at women and a much more diverse workplace. You know, we need to pay our interns better. We need to pay people at the bottom scale so that people from different backgrounds can join in. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we still really underpay young people in the business, which means that, you know, you see a lot more privileged kids in the business because their families can afford
Absolutely.
Them to live in London and be in the business. I think that, you know, having kids for women particularly, I've got an incredible wife who I love, who's a rock at home, and, you know, I couldn't do any of it without her. But I think having kids for women in the business is really tough. You know, I think because of that nature of living out and going to shows and doing that whole thing. And I think that there needs to be a bit more thought about that. I think there needs to be a little bit more, you know, I think we need to park the ego a little bit. I think artists and operators and kind of go, look, you know, I've got two kids. So I can't come out on a Tuesday night. But
that should be,
you know,
okay.
But the three guys that are working for me are there and, you know, I'll come to the one on Friday or Saturday, you know. But I think it's on us. I do think it's on, and I've been very fortunate. Emma Banks, Mark Moreau, Paul Oakenfold, you know, Barry and the Drinkwaters and my dad, obviously, my brother. But, you know, all the people that have mentored me and pulled me through, I think you get to a middle age, 40-something, and you kind of go, spend some time with other people, spend some time helping people out, because, you know, that's the if you want good people in the business, you've got to help good people get in it, you know, and keep it a good business.
Yeah.
If you want a load of sharks in it, then, you know, ignore the kids at the bottom and they will become sharks. It's like, there are good values in this business. You know, there should be. You know, there's no reason why we shouldn't do great things and make great things and collaborate and do brilliant things. We don't have to be caricatures of what music business people should look like.
Or the villains, you know, that can sometimes be painted out.
And they're great. They're great in those old school films, right? They're great in, you know, there's a villain, probably the manager's the villain in Rocket Man, or, you know, the manager's
kill your friend.
And they're great. But it's pastiche and it's old. And it's not what we are anymore. We're a modern business and we don't need to be that other business. So, you know, pay it forward a little bit, I think.
I think that's brilliant advice and a perfect note to end the podcast on. So, Jake, thank you so much for all of your expertise and all your nuggets of information. I think you have really explained some vital parts of the industry and the agent side, the management side. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome.
So that's it for today's episode. A big thank you to Jake for joining me. I also want to say a big thanks to Juliet from Pineapple Productions, to Soho Radio, where we recorded this episode, and to Sonny. The music that you've heard in this podcast and on all of the episodes is from @NowThisIsSonny. If you want to hear more from him, look him up on Spotify, simply Sonny. Thanks, and I will see you guys next week.